I am Danny Carroll Rodas. I am the Scripture Press Ministries Professor of Biblical Studies and Pedagogy at Wheaton College Graduate School.
Dr. Danny Carroll, good to see you today. Thanks for being with us.
Well, it's great to be with you, David, as it always is.
Yeah, it's fun. I miss you. I always enjoy seeing you, and we've had some great conversations over the years. We're here today to talk about your book, new book, The Lord Roars, Recovering the Prophetic Voice for Today. It's published by Baker Academic and is part of a series that's coming out. Now, what's the series about? Tell us about that.
Well, the Nazarene Theological Seminary in Kansas City has an annual lecture, and so Baker has the contract for the lectures. So this is actually another in a series of books that have come out, but it's based on some lectures I gave. It's been now 2 years. In October, it'll be 2 years. On the prophets and the prophetic voice. And so that's what you're reading. It's not a big book. It's about maybe 150 pages, but that's why, because it's based on some lectures there.
Yeah, I love the size of the book because, you know, it's the kind of book that you can read and get through in a short period of time. I'm reading another book now, about 800 pages.
Oh my gosh.
And it's just the kind of thing that, am I ever going to reach even the, you know, middle of this book? So at any rate, this is a great size. It's a great set. I think there are three or four chapters in it. And you do a variety of things in the book, but I have to mention the name Andy Johnson here, because Andy Johnson was your handler there.
Right.
Stu, Andy's a friend of mine. I've known him for a long time. He helped to kind of organize, I guess, the lecture and runs the lecture. He's a professor of theology and New Testament there at Nazarene Theological Seminary in Kansas City, home of the Kansas City Royals, which he would want me to tell you. So tell me about the title of the book, The Lord Roars. Let's begin with that.
Yes, I do a lot of my work in the prophets, and the one I've worked most on over the years is the book of Amos. And in Amos, the Lord, Yahweh, is a lion. And that's how the book begins. Actually, the Lord is roaring from Zion. And the roaring, of course, is a warning. And there's a sense of urgency to it. So I thought, well, that might be a nice way of doing it, because the prophets were very serious and very urgent, trying to get the people to change before it was too late.
Now, you focus on three prophets here, Amos, Isaiah, and Micah. Why those three?
Well, these are the three that people will tend to go to when they think about ethics and the prophets. Isaiah, of course, is much bigger than the other two, but these are the three. And so I thought, well, it also makes the book a little more manageable. Instead of trying to do all the prophets, all of them will have some kind of message dealing with ethical demand. But these are the three that people go to. And they all are dated, you know, in their presentation in the 8th century. So they're kind of overlapping in terms of what they're looking at. And so there's a bit of overlap is in the messaging. So that helps weave them together more easily than trying to hook it up with maybe with Malachi or something. Malachi will get hard with ethics, but it's a wholly different world that he's dealing with than what these prophets were working with.
So let's talk a little bit about that. If you were to describe that world, if you were to say, you know, what is this world like for us living in the 21st century in the West? What was going on that caused the Lord to roar, to warn them?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question. And there's a bunch of studies that have been done trying to use social sciences to actually identify how it worked. And there's various hypotheses about how the oppression worked, the economics of it, the politics of it, the social strata that were involved in. And sometimes those theories are very different. But what they do is they do add a sense of realism to it, because when people say, oh, the prophets were against injustice, and so you go, okay, so what does that mean? What exactly was it?
Yeah.
So there's different theories about that. But what we find, we think, is a world with very stratified. So you had kind of the ruling classes. Even in this country, you have, you know, a political class, for instance. You would have had that. Massive poverty, maybe in ancient Israel, 90% of the population would have been peasant farmers. Cities were very small. We think of cities, we think of millions of people or hundreds of thousands. Well, there you'd see, you know, just several thousand, that would be a city.
Yeah.
So the cities were a lot smaller. War was a constant reality to them. For us, it's an exception. Something on the other side of the world, well, for them, it was something that they had in their annual experience. Drought was always a recurring problem because of, even today, the rainfall in Israel. So it was a world of a lot of poverty, a hard life. People didn't live that long. And we think that perhaps up to half of the children died by age 5. So you had this small, wealthy class, and underneath them was the beginnings of merchants, you know, people in the cities running businesses, traders, things like this, government officials. And so a hard world, a world of when life wasn't easy, and on top of it not being easy, it wasn't fair. And what made it worse for the prophets, and this is something that we see all around the world throughout history in every religion actually, is that the people who were kind of in control and leading the religious world, the priests, and what you would find at the temples, they'd crafted a theology that had become a nationalistic ideology so that the religion actually supported and legitimated the way things were and celebrated it. And so the idea that God was going to bless and was blessing the nation with all of its injustice, God would help their armies win and all this kind of thing. The prophets attack, because that is really an idol. That's not the God of what we would say the Bible. That is a God that they had crafted to fit their own ideas of politics and society and economics, mm-hmm. which is something, like I said, every religion does.
Yeah.
But the prophets are hitting hard at it.
Well, this oppression of the poor keeps coming out over and over again, and these feasts that are celebrated, religious feasts, and yet there seem to be empty of real life. I mean, so much in the prophets that comes along. On the back of the book, it calls you, and I think this is true, a leading Old Testament ethicist. And when we think about ethics, when we think about biblical ethics, you're one of those people that have been very strongly advocating for years that we read these texts very ethically. Your last podcast with us that we'll put in the show notes gives a little bit more about your life, and it went in a bit to talk about the immigration issue that we're facing, you know, here in the United States. And you were here, well, not just in the United States, but all over the world, as I
right.
recall.
Right.
And you were here speaking, giving a lecture at the Lanier Theological Library a while back. So we're really grateful for that. We'll let people know and give them some access to that as well. But when you think about these prophets and you think about them as ethicists, one of the terms that you use, that I remember Walter Brueggemann used, was the prophetic imagination.
Right.
And very often it seems to me, we work primarily just kind of rules and regulations. But in fact, the prophetic imagination is very important. Tell us a little bit what you mean by that phrase, the prophetic imagination.
Yeah, I would say a couple of things, and let me begin by way of an illustration, one that people, I think, could identify with. If you watch or just listen to a talk or a speech given by Martin Luther King, what you will hear is an amazing language with a certain cadence to it, things like this, that actually moves, and you would see the same on a written page, and that's what we have, is the written page. And what happens when people talk about ethics or justice or injustice in the prophets, they look for a verse or two. But what they're missing is the language, the metaphors, the images, the very direct calls. They're very vibrant and shocking. And so the prophetic imagination, as you were saying, it goes back to Brueggemann, is this idea of trying to get into people's minds and how they look at the world. And one of the ways the Bible does it, and good literature in general will do it, is through its language, through its characters, through its scenes, that actually grips you and actually will change how you look at life. The illustration I use oftentimes when I'm teaching is I have a set of glasses. And the thing is, if I take those glasses off, I can still see the world around me, but it's blurred.
Mm-hmm.
And I put these glasses on and it becomes clear. And I think that's the idea. You see, everyone around us can see the injustice, or maybe they just ignore it. They can see things aren't right, but they don't understand why it's wrong. They don't understand why they need to evaluate it. And then you put on the biblical lens, and now you have God's view of it. and God now, because humans are made in his image. When we find oppression, we are seeing the violation of his image, which ultimately is a violation of God himself. And what makes the anger go up is that people will worship him as if he actually condoned this, as if actually he supports this. And so he's not only angry at the sin that's going on, social, systemic sin, as well as individuals. He's angry because they've created their own God with his name on it and worship him. And so, you know, one last comment, David. I don't want to take too much time on this point, but
no, that's important, though.
Okay, when people say, oh, don't make work your idol. Well, work's not your idol. It may be your obsession. An idol is something you sing to, you pray to, you give money to. And so this is why the temples become so important, you see, because it's in those sacred spaces that they are worshiping a God that they created. And so we do the same thing, you see. So we go into a church, and that church will present and propagate a certain view of God in the songs they sing, in the sermons they preach, in how they structure the service, the topics they will not talk about, and the topics they do talk about. And they're actually crafting an image of God. And that's what people pray to, and that's what people give money to, and that's what people will dedicate their lives to. That's the idolatry that the prophets are hitting at, you see. They're not hitting at the obsessions only, but they're hitting at the idols, in this case, the idol called Yahweh, that supposedly sanctifies and legitimates it. That's why God's so angry.
But he's being mischaracterized in so many ways, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, and were those mischaracterizations, you think, intentional and malevolent? Or did they just fall into this, they inherit this? Well, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's actually both. I mean, if you were to evaluate, you're in Houston, if you were to evaluate churches in Houston, and if I were to ask you the same question, the answer would be, well, it's both. I mean, some people will take advantage of it. It's what people do. I mean, religious leaders. I mean, we have all these scandals of religious leaders, sadly.
Right.
But what you're seeing, it's very self-conscious, and they're taking advantage of their position and enriching themselves and using their position, you know, for social climbing and all kinds of perks. And is it conscious? Very much so. But then you have the people in the pew, you see. For them, a lot of it's not self-conscious. That's just what they do. And that's what makes it even more insidious, because it's not only that the leadership is doing all these things that are wrong self-consciously for their own benefit, is that all these people have trusted them and are following it, believing that this is the right way to do. And it just perpetuates itself, and it ripples through a whole society in all kinds of, if I can use this word, kind of perverted ways. And as we know, just again, what we've seen with the leadership and the scandals, it just ruins the testimony of the Christian church and of the Christian God.
Right, yeah.
That would be the same thing if we could kind of, you know, transport it back. It's the same kind of idea going on. Mm-hmm. But God is stepping in, you see.
At that point in the 8th century.
At that point.
Yeah. If we were to put on your prophetic hat at this time, and say, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Danny. And what does he say to the churches today?
Oh my gosh.
That's pretty tough, isn't it?
Yeah, to quote Amos, I'm not a prophet nor a son of a prophet.
but you have the prophetic imagination, right? You have the idea. I mean, you're living in this world of metaphor, and you're living in this world.
Yeah.
That's really an unfair question. I'll retract it here in a minute. But I just think...
in a minute.
I'll let you struggle a little bit first with it. I mean, in a sense, we're not used to even thinking in those terms. The prophets are people who spoke in the past, but people would argue that there are still prophets today that have the cadence, that have the poetry, that have the images, and that can inspire and move people. And they may be in the black church, may be in the white church, they may be in all kinds of churches. Right. Or they may be not in the churches at all. They may be outside them in some ways. Yeah. But I was just, you know, we're just not used to thinking in those terms, are we?
Yeah, and I think today, at least in kind of religious circles, you'll hear this idea of the prophetic voice or the prophetic church or he's a prophet. I don't think people really know what that means. It's just kind of a word they use. And what I try to do in the book, and I actually say, is that these were deeply theological people. So it wasn't just the cadence or trying to stir people up. I mean, this was deeply theological, a deep knowledge of God, a deep commitment to the people and to God. And so it's a prophet of a certain kind. It's not just an activist. And that's sometimes what people think of when they think of the prophetic voice.
Yeah.
And the thing that I, you know, maybe because I've lived overseas for a lot of my life and in several countries, what I see when I come into this country, of course, is that left and right are using religion to bolster their positions. I mean, so they're very different positions, but they go to different verses, but they're both using very strong condemning language to the other side.
Yeah.
And just, you know, the prophetic voice is singular, but it can degenerate into mudslinging.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's not very theological, nor is it very honest. Yeah. And so that's another problem that we have, that both sides are claiming that they speak for God.
Yeah.
When I would say curse on both your houses.
Neither one of you. My favorite chapter, I think it was chapter 2, worship and social responsibility. We're just about out of time. Connect those dots. We think of worship as something over here that we do on the side on in a particular place at a particular time. We think of social responsibility as something else altogether. So what do you do in that chapter, very briefly?
Well, I think I'm just trying to have the worship discussion go in a different direction, you see. So we think of worship as kind of singing and preaching. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, that's the mechanics of it. But if you ask the question, what does worship do? Then that's a different kind of question. So it's the question ultimately is not, did you like it this morning or this afternoon or this evening? The question is, what kind of person are you once you've been through this, you see? So worship should be very self-consciously formative. So are you more just? Are you more compassionate? Are you kinder because you heard a word from God? And so it's not now a question of performance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's a question of moral and ethical shaping. I think that's part of the problem, because people will want to go to a show. They'll want to go to a big church, and they want to see the music, and this guy better be good when he preaches, which is just all the wrong questions.
Yeah.
Questions should be, is God pleased?
Yes.
Are you different because of this, you see? Yeah. And I think once you start asking those kind of questions, we redirect worship. The problem that we have is that people are so invested in the models that they already have, whether there's people who are singing or people who are preaching and all these other things, that to try to reform it properly is very hard. And it gets so bad in the Old Testament, where God will just destroy the temple because it is irredeemable. And so the idea is, I will just tear the whole thing down. And
start over, right?
Which is what they do when they come back from the exile.
Right.
But then a few centuries later, what is Jesus doing? He's whipping people in the temple because it's the same problem, you see.
Yeah.
So it's not unique to us. I've seen it in the countries I've lived in. You know, it's all the wrong questions. And this is why the idolatry of a false Yahweh is so hard to identify and then hard to eradicate.
Mm, great word.
It calls for a lot of change.
Yeah, we're talking to Dr. Daniel Carroll Rodas. He's written a wonderful book called The Lord Roars, Recovering the Prophetic Voice for Today. You can find it at your friendly Lanier Theological Library, probably in multiple copies, not this one because this one's mine. But Danny, thanks for being with us today on the Stone Chapel.
Well, thanks for having me, friend.
One of the things I love about doing these podcasts is that inevitably I learned something, whether I wanted to or not. And today I did, and I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. For more info about our guest, check out our show notes. They're there for you. Subscribe to the podcast. We'd love to hear from you. Leave us a comment. Rate us. You know the drill. We're on Apple and Google and Spotify and iHeartRadio and Stitcher and other places. I want to say thanks to those that make this podcast possible, for Kathy Capes, Jocelyn Solis, Phil Kagi, and the Lanier Foundation. Let's give it up for them. Cue the applause track. Thanks for listening.
A final word I'd want to leave with people is found in the book of Amos, and it's a shocking word. He goes, "Come to Bethel and transgress, to Gilgal and multiply transgression. Worship has become sin. Bring your sacrifices every morning and your tithes every 3 days. Offer a sacrifice of thanksgiving of that which is leavened, and proclaim free will offerings and publish them." And here's the line, "For so you love to do, O people of Israel." Is worship about pleasing ourselves and our own way of doing things, or is it about actually serving God? That's my final word, a prophetic word from the book of Amos.